Good morning. I'm Joe Donahue, and I think I may have my act together. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. It's Monday, the 25th of September. I came into the studio earlier to do what we call the billboard. The billboard is from 9 to 9:01, and I spoke a bunch of words, but none of them were coherent or in a complete sentence.
That's not true.
I was looking forward to hearing what was next.
You're being nice.
I was standing outside, and it was all coherent. I blanked completely
on the CIA, on the Culinary Institute of America, and
the folks coming there. I just lost it.
So anyway, good morning. I think we got our act together. Good morning. Welcome to the program. Very nice to have you with us on a Monday morning. If something like that's going to happen, it's going to happen on a Monday. And we are thrilled because we have a great group, a great lineup here today. Let me tell you a little bit about who is here. First, Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
How's your back? How's your back?
Well, the doc says 2 weeks before, no pain. We're a week into it, minus a day. In other words, we're less.
Tomorrow will be a week. Yep.
And it's getting a little bit better. There's no question. There's no question about it.
No pain, no gain, right?
No pain. Well.
A little bit of pain.
A little bit of pain. All right. Well, welcome. We're glad you're feeling better. That's hopefully you'll be on the mend, and we'll be back.
I'll just sit here in the dark and
nothing wrong with that.
No.
I mean, you know, it's radio. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
Libby Post is here.
Yes.
Libby Post is a political consultant. She joins us on Mondays. She is looking bright and pink and just beautiful today. Good morning.
Thank
How are you,
dear. I'm fine.
Very nice to have you with us. Teresa Bourgeois joins us. She's a communications consultant. She joins us on Mondays as well. And you always look just are happy to be here.
Vibrant. Happy to be alive.
That's what we love. That's very nice. We are expecting the district attorney from the Albany County, David Soares, who will be with us in a little bit, and we look forward to having him. We also welcome to our program Keith Strudler. You know him. He is a commentator for this radio station as well as a frequent guest on Vox Pop. He is currently director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University, a new gig for him after leaving Marist, and we're thrilled to have Keith on the program. Keith, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Alan, I hope your back's okay.
No, it's fine. It'll be well.
I'm concerned. I'm worried about you. Know that you're in good company, though. Good friend of mine, and probably yours as well, broadcast journalist Jack Ford, also recently had back surgery. So hopefully the two of you can mend in commensurate fashion.
And be ready to go.
I have a great doc, Dr. Zhang Shen. Hands never go in your body. It's all robotic. He's a brilliant man. So he's been terrific.
Well, good.
Future is plastics. Yeah.
Well, we wanted Keith here this morning because we want to talk a little bit about what's going on. Of course, the big story over the weekend was the NFL. All of this happened, there would have been some kneeling, there would have been some perhaps protest, as there has been over the first couple of games of the season. But then on Friday, the president of the United States went to Alabama. What could go wrong? Well, he took on the NFL and made some very derogatory comments toward the people who do kneel and sit out the national anthem, saying that they should be fired, and then went on to some other things. We got tweets then about Steph Curry and dissing him for saying that if he didn't want to come to the White House and it was such a decision, then okay, he wasn't invited. Then he also went off on the thing about and this to me. And Keith, I don't know how you feel about this, but to me, this was the most disturbing of what he said, was basically, with all we know about brain injury, with all we know about football, with all we know about CTE, et cetera, the president basically says, it's a lot better if you just get roughed up in the field.
Sure, just tough it out. You know, I think the takeaway here is if your organization finds itself kind of in disruption, make sure that the president says something bad about you. Who knew that Damaris Smith, the head of the Players Association, and Roger Goodell could get on the same page and do a joint press release. Mm-hmm. How wonderful is that? So it's in some odd way, the president did the NFL an enormous favor by, in essence, galvanizing the public behind what was truly a disruptive source. I mean, I think the kneeling issue, and calling it an issue is probably a disservice, but the kneeling issue had become, you know, problematic a bit for the league. And all of a sudden, because the president, with his, you know, 60%+ disapproval rating, has managed to get a good percentage of the public behind the players, the teams, and so forth. So, you know, maybe he is a great unifier, just not in the way he thinks he is. But, I mean, it's kind of odd. I think in some ways this inoculated the league, the NFL to some degree, which is the more conservative of the sports leagues, certainly the NBA. I mean, I right now the NBA is – which the NBA, an organization which is often on the right side of history, is looking quite good as the Golden State Warriors and their very eloquent coach, Steve Kerr – have really kind of put a line in the sand about what's right and what's wrong. And I think, you know, as often is the case, the professional sports leagues will come out looking really good. And by the way, also lost in the shuffle, UNC, the UNC basketball program, has also said they're not going to the White House. And so this is trickling down to the collegiate level as well. And so, boy, I mean, if Trump thinks this is a good way to win over his base by angering, you know, the fans of all of the major and amateur sports leagues, including some of these swing states, he's probably sorely mistaken.
I have about 100 questions, but let me just start with this one. Why don't we have this issue in baseball, Keith?
Well, baseball is not a unified organization. It's a series of fiefdoms that come together every couple of days to play against each other. It's a good question. I think, though, baseball doesn't have the singular unified voice that I think certainly the NFL and the NBA does. So I think in that regard, there isn't – I mean, there's not a commissioner's – there is a commissioner's office, obviously, but it doesn't yield the same kind of power that it does in the other organizations. I think the players also have a little bit less kind of oomph, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Very few baseball players have that – kind of singularity. Baseball is kind of a regional game, so what happens in your particular jurisdiction is probably more important than what happens in another part of the country. I mean, Colin Kaepernick was a national story, and Steph Curry is a national story. There is hardly a baseball player that's even known nationally, and probably the ones that are retired, like Derek Jeter.
All right.
So perhaps it's the regionality and the lack of centralized focus. I guess if you were to be the cynical, you might suggest this is because baseball doesn't have the importance, perhaps, that the other sports do. And I guess lastly, you could suggest that of all the professional sports, baseball is the least, and I don't know the numbers on this specifically, and I'm saying this incorrectly, but certainly has a very important racial history, it doesn't have the racial constituency that we see in the other professional sports leagues, where you have a majority African-American playing populace, often playing for a series of white coaches and owners. So there's a racial dynamic that's quite different in baseball than there is in basketball and football.
So before we throw this around to the panel at large, let me just also ask this question, because this is something my brain can't quite figure out. So through all of this, and as the president said, you throw the son of a bitch off the field. So why? But right now, Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job because basically he kneeled during the national anthem. But there are people who have been charged with drugs, with guns, with domestic violence, with spousal abuse, and they're playing, and they played yesterday. There seems to be something wrong with that.
Well, Joe, if you can't figure it out, I certainly can't figure it out.
How the hell does that make any sense?
It's a great quandary of why Colin Kaepernick's not playing. Now, let's not forget the fact that Colin Kaepernick was not having the greatest run as an NFL quarterback when things started to go south. So there is a little part of this that is should be, you know, in the end of the day, if you can play, you can play. And there's probably a home for you in the NFL. And that goes for a lot of people who have done a lot of bad things. Although I'm quite certain that most NFL owners didn't want to bring the attention of kneeling to their particular jurisdiction and stadium, although that's no longer an issue. It was kind of interesting, you know, when the Pittsburgh Steelers, I believe, stayed in the locker room and didn't come out for the national anthem. And someone made, I mean, there was a lot of snide comments on social, but
right.
There was one to the effect of, you know, that's great, all the, and I apologize for the vernacular, all the rapists can stay in the locker room and talk to each other and kneel together. And I think that was a jab at Ben Roethlisberger for some previous assault charges that he endured in his career. So, you know, it's an interesting quandary, and it's one that the league has dealt with quite a bit and has tried to figure out what to do with things like domestic abuse and all of the other things that seem to happen off the field. And I don't have a great answer, but I do think in some regard, I think largely because the president has made it such, I think there's going to be a wider berth now for athletes to have a political voice that they weren't privileged to before.
David Soares. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Nice to have you here. What do you make of this?
Well, I just one issue I would take, and that is baseball. For the very first time over the weekend, we had one player kneel,
right.
And that's drawn some major attention. But professional athletes, especially professional athletes of color, who historically have been underrepresented in sports, most of them have always taken a stand, whether you're talking about the Olympics in Germany mm-hmm. or you look at players and a personal hero of mine, Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You've had athletes who have prominence in sports. They've always taken a great political stance. As a matter of fact, a person who I've enjoyed as a player historically but never admired as anyone who I thought – seize the mantle to bring about change was Michael Jordan. You're never going to see profiles and courage with respect to his political activity. Colin Kaepernick, you know, the one thing that I believe occurred over this weekend is Colin Kaepernick was pretty much a marginalized individual. I think that had the president not mentioned this over the weekend, he probably would have stayed out the entire season and we wouldn't have been talking about him as the race for the division leads would take place over the next couple of weeks. And what this president has managed to do is thrust this young man right back into the forefront. And it's caused, you know, that infamous debate about substance over process. I mean, the idea that a person who's exercising his right to protest an issue that he along with many other Americans believe to be a problem in this country and decides to take a knee over the national anthem. The fact that we're once again having this discussion, to me, is truly absurd. You know, the idea that we prize the symbol of a flag over what that flag, you know, stands for. I mean, the flag stands for the fact that this young man can go ahead and engage in civil disobedience. And if his choice is to take a knee, then that's his choice. It's not my choice, but it certainly is his choice. And the idea that also you would need, you know, some consensus from the majority, and you'd need some agreement from the majority as to what are appropriate methods to protest, again, is absurd and quite un-American. But, you know, this is an issue that unfortunately is not going to go away. And I think thanks to this president, you're going to see this, you know, it's going to have a major staying power and it will be the backdrop for all of the sports activities in the next several weeks, I think.
Alan.
Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff here, obviously, and nothing I'm saying now should surprise anybody. The first is that he is playing to this base of his that he thinks is so important. You see him go down, was it Alabama, and you know he makes these incendiary statements. That is base oriented. The second is bright shining object. We all know about it. You know, as David just says, there's always the possibility here that he knows he's got all of these problems. He's failing on health care. He's failing all over the other place. And so he goes here. And that is, again, classic bright shining object. He's got North Korea. He tries playing to the base with that one. But now we're talking nuclear bombs and the possibility of World War One type stepping into the breach with an uninvited war that nobody wants. So it's interesting that we do this first, and believe me, I understand it. But if you accept the idea that he's trying to get out from under all his other problems by raising this kind of thing once again, you really got something.
Teresa, what do you make?
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I think that somebody wrote this weekend that he uses cultural rifts to distract from policy weaknesses, and I think that that's right on target. I think that somebody also noted that the White House was celebrating that the Sunday shows, that this shifted the focus of the Sunday shows, because really he did not do very well at the UN General Assembly last week. He's really raised tensions in a very dangerous way in North Korea. He's resumed bombing in Libya. The healthcare question is, you know, pretty precarious.
So Steve Mnuchin got on and said you can have free speech as long as it's off the field.
Well, let's get to this. Well, that's, you know, sort of, A, it's a distraction, but B, it's a dangerous one. I think that it just exacerbates, you know, leaders are supposed to heal and bring people together, and this leader uses these efforts to try to he uses dividing people as a tool. I thought Steve Kerr's comment, I won't read the whole statement, but Steve Kerr's comment was really right on target about Donald Trump. He was talking about what it means to be a leader and how, as a coach, he's a leader. And he talks about how you have to be prepared to be criticized. He says, maybe respond, you know, people are going to take shots at you and it's incumbent upon you to absorb those shots. Maybe you respond diplomatically, but you maintain a level of respect and dignity. What you can't do is just angrily lash out. Can you imagine if I lashed out at all my critics every day and belittled them? I'd lose my players. I'd embarrass ownership. I'd embarrass myself. Pretty soon I'd be out of a job. It's a basic adult thing that you learn as you grow up. People aren't always going to agree with you, and that's okay. You know, his whole statement, but that's just a piece of it. I thought that was a good summary of Trump. It's a real problem.
Libby, you're a football fan. What'd you make of it?
Well, I think the uber nationalism that we're presently living through, this notion that we have to revere the flag and revere the national anthem, and I'm a political consultant, so on that level, I get it. But on a human rights level and on a level of one-to-one, I think that, we as a country, we are singular in our raising of the flag to the point of deity. And I think that Trump knows how to push those buttons. The people behind him know how to push the nationalist buttons. And, I'm glad they all took a knee. And I don't have a problem with anybody sitting through the national anthem. I don't see this as your test of patriotism. Your test of patriotism is standing up for the First Amendment. Your test of patriotism is saying to the owners in the NFL, you need to tell your players to stop beating up on women and raping women and that domestic violence is okay. Because they don't fire them for that. They fire them for taking a knee. Now, I'm hoping Colin gets a job and comes back onto the field. Whether he's mediocre or not, he's better than I am. And, he can play.
And therein lies the gold standard, yeah.
But the fact is that what are they going to do? Fire all these other people? I don't think so. And, you know, this is an issue of race in America. And I thought the comments earlier about baseball being regional and all that sort of stuff was interesting. I also thought that the baseball commissioner, when he got on the air, I had no idea who he was. You know, there's no level. There's no Bowie Kuhn anymore. There's not even a Bert Giamatti, you know, somebody that you know. And so I think that has taken baseball down a notch. But This is about standing up for the First Amendment and our freedom of speech. And if you can't do it by burning a flag or speaking out against injustice and speaking for what's right in this country and what this country stands for, then we really are in trouble.
But the president also stood up, remember, in Charlottesville for neo-Nazis' right to protest.
Well, yeah.
But he says that black athletes should be fired if they protest. I mean, that's a core...
I think it's a distraction, but it's a disgusting, dangerous, he's an absolute racist.
The core issue here, and I think it's been overlooked because of the NFL's involvement this past weekend. But Colin Kaepernick was protesting the injustices experienced by especially young men of color, but people of color in particular. This all occurred as a result of all of the shootings that were caught on video and broadcast throughout the world on the internet last year, and so this young man decided to exercise to take you know his moment in the stage that is perhaps the highest platform for a young man like that. He decided to take that opportunity to speak his mind with respect to an issue. Now, the only issue I take with Colin Kaepernick is when he was asked about, you know, who he voted for. He just said he didn't vote.
Right.
You know, which is absurd, because I think that if you're going to take that position and express your right to free speech and demonstrate to the world that, you know, the Bill of Rights is an essential tool for us in this country, then you go right down the line and then you vote. That's where you actually can bring about change. And I think he failed to do that. But juxtapose that with the president of the United States several weeks ago observing other people in the process of expressing their First Amendment rights, denigrating Jews, talking about African Americans. And he basically stood up for those people, which if you're an African American person, a person of color, right now, watching this man engage in his presidential duties and the comments that he's making, you're scratching your head and wondering, who is this and how did we get to this space in the United States of America in 2017?
And we knew before Election Day that he did this kind of This is not new.
Well, that's right. This is what we elected. Keith, I want to ask you a question then. Please. But, you know, Bob Costas was on Bill Maher over the weekend, and Bob Costas, of course, the legendary NBC sportscaster. And he said, what if you change the stadium recordings instead of please stand for the national anthem to please stand for the national anthem and the ideals it represents? Would that make a difference, do you think?
Boy, you know, first off, I just want to point out Rob Manfred, Commissioner of Baseball, very progressive guy and a very proud Cornell ILR graduate, so should be noted. His job is very
thank
different
you.
Than
the
here,
other
here.
Commissioners. There you go. His job is very different than the other commissioners. In many ways, he's more like an academic dean than a business leader. He's herding cats in a way that the other commissioners are not. You know, Adam Silver can snap his fingers and people will come to attention. Rob Manfred can snap his fingers and I don't think anyone in his office will notice. So no offense to him or his office. They're great people. You know, the NFL, for its history, has become America's sport, not baseball, because it shrouded itself in the American flag and made itself kind of a version of America. You know, they call it football is America and America is football, and the Super Bowl becomes, you know, the country's proudest holiday. So the NFL is going to have to figure out if it's going to unwrap itself from kind of that ethos, particularly in an era of globalization, and perhaps, you know, maybe stop having the players come out in the field before the national anthem, shift over to God Bless America, which, by the way, I think is a much better song anyway and should have been our national anthem, just a personal preference. I don't know that simply adding that line is going to make that much of a difference, with all due respect to Bob Costas, who's the dean of sports. I think right now the NFL is in very, very deep with America, I suppose. And so
because,
that's going to be...
Because they get paid by...
Right.
I'm sorry.
I
got it. They get paid a lot of money by the Defense Department.
To bring the flag.
Absolutely.
This is a corporate deal for them. It's also been a good sales pitch.
There's the simple narrative that they get paid money from the Defense Department, and they get... But long before that, you know, the Super Bowl became an American celebration a long time ago. And having the military jets fly over, all of this stuff. they've been America for generations at this point. And so there's an unraveling that would have to happen.
And I love
as much in other sports.
I guess baseball is America's sport. Well,
The NFL is America's sport only because the attention span of its fans.
Right.
It pleases the attention span of the fans who cannot sit through a baseball game. I'm a diehard Red Sox fan, diehard football fan, and I don't think we should do anything to change, you know, the singing of the national anthem in sports.
Yeah, no.
I think it centers people. It's calming. It centers us. It reminds us where we are and who we are. Before we begin to yell at one another and root for our teams.
And think about right after 9/11, or think about after the Boston bombing, that moment in Fenway Park. You know, it just brought us different moments that are important coming together.
But I think America the Beautiful would be a better song to sing. Anyway. Not God Bless America.
So let's vote on that. Yeah.
Okay, but I think America the Beautiful is...
Alan?
Well,
but also...
No,
I
just wanted to say one thing, and what's being missed here, which is real interesting, although people have come close to it this morning, is that this whole thing is a business.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, here we have...
A gargantuan business. Mm-hmm.
And the owners didn't step out until Trump tweeted about not coming and putting fans, that's when the owners stood out. I'm sorry,
right.
Alan, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. And here we have Kraft. Well, how much did he give Trump? $1 million.
Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots. Go ahead.
Patriots. $1 million, I understand. And he has to come out and criticize him. He doesn't like his tone. He doesn't like what he's saying, because now he's messing with his business, and business is everything in America.
Yeah, and by the way, I would like to make the point that when Trump says, I think you should all get up and walk out of the stadium, let me tell you what, if you just spent $250 to watch a Golden State game, which is what you're going to spend on the open market, you're not going anywhere.
No.
I'm not a football person, clearly, and I'm not even going to my rant about how dangerous it is, but I think Indianapolis is the only place that was booing, right? Am I right?
Oh, no, there were
a couple of places, even in the Redskins game last night.
Yeah, but they boo Santa Claus. I mean, they boo everything. Booing is, that's just how they communicate.
You're going to find a 30% everywhere you go.
I mean, are you saying that it's a Neanderthal kind of thing? That's how they communicate?
Well, I once talked with a couple that said that they've never argued, and my wife and I will then ask, well, how do you talk to each other? Like, how do you communicate? Because
I like
booing
it.
Is part of the vernacular of sports. That's simply what happens. But people if Colin Kaepernick sits for the national anthem and then goes out and throws 6 touchdowns and wins a football game,
right.
That's
they're not
I
booing.
About.
I mean, they will boo him when he can't complete a pass. So people come around really, and this comes back to the story of why will people continue to cheer for someone who's been accused of sexual assault and in some cases murder and you know, all of that. It's because in the end of the day, they want to cheer for a winner. That passion towards their sports team is where it's at.
Can I pause right here? We have to take a break. Let's do that. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We've got a lot of letters on this, and we will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here, Keith Strudler, Libby Post, David Soares, Teresa Bourgeois. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Keith, are you on a time crunch?
No, I'm good. I'm just sitting here at a rest stop between New Jersey and New York State line. You see a lot of remarkable things. But I will tell you, it's heating up in here. I'm gonna have to roll down the windows at some point.
All right. Well,
the conversation or the weather?
All right. We're gonna hold on. We'll hold on to you if we can for another 15 minutes or so.
Then I'll
let you get air. Here we got a lot of letters. And so let's go to those and start digging in. Michael writes, why did they even play the national anthem before a football game? Football is entertainment, pure and simple. It is a show put on by highly paid professionals for paying fans. It's really not all that different from a rock concert. There's nothing patriotic about watching a football game. The NFL has usurped patriotism, and now it's coming back to bite them. Keith.
That's a great point. I mean, it's a marketing tool. It's a way to sell the sport as part of America, to frame the discourse, to make this seem as it is as it is, as if it is part of the kind of the American tradition and something that should receive all the tax abatements that it receives from all our municipalities, and it serves as American holidays and so forth. A very good point. No real reason we need to do it. You don't see it before a concert or any of the other things that seem to go on. And it's many times it's forced. You know, someone who did college and high school sports, there were times when we would be warming up for like a track meet or a cross country meet, and we'd be right in the throes of this is about to happen, and we'd all have to sit there and stop while they found like a horrible like 1970s recorded version of the national anthem, so we could all sit there and do our due diligence to the country. So I agree, it doesn't serve a real purpose other than kind of a marketing one.
And we've had a number of requests that we would explain, if anybody can, why the Defense Department pays to have this done.
PBS did an investigation. They gave $5 million between 2011 and 2014, just as an example, to honor U.S. soldiers and veterans at games. And given to the teams across the country, supplied, I think it was National Guard as well as the Army and Air Force. And it was in all forms, from what I understand, for halftime shows, for the giant flag celebrations, flyovers. To the honoring for the flyovers. And that was a payment to the NFL. And I believe that even in some cases prior to 2008, the players didn't even come out on the field prior to the national anthem. So this was all an orchestrated attempt through a deal with the United States Defense Department and the National Football League to put this patriotism on display. Did I get any of that wrong?
And it was the underlying issue was a recruiting, but it was part of the Defense Department recruiting budget.
So. Hopefully that explains a little bit of that.
Go ahead, Katie. Now it seems the only people in the government that anyone trusts are the military guys. So the irony, they don't even need to spend it anymore. Maybe the politicians need to spend and get themselves some marketing with the NFL, because they're the ones we don't trust anymore. All the lawyers, perhaps. But yeah, that is all correct. It's a symbiotic marketing buy, and certainly it helps with recruiting and so forth. But perhaps it's something whose time has passed, and perhaps we can just leave the patriotism to the Olympics, although they're having their own troubles with that.
I think there's a lot of room here for disagreement. The national anthem at a sporting event is the one thing that it's a reminder that first and foremost we're Americans before we're Cowboy fans, we're Americans before we're Giant fans. And it brings people together for that moment, and it's not something that I think should even be debated as to whether we get rid of it.
But what happens when they start playing over in Europe and can't in a hockey?
Well, we do what we do in boxing. We allow for the national anthem of whoever of the nation that other fighter is representing, and then we do the national anthem. And when you do national anthems, it elevates the specter of the sport. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to keep the national anthem.
Right. They did it yesterday in London. They do baseball games when you play in Canada. You play both hockey games. Mm-hmm. You play, you know.
My kids root for Premier League soccer teams, and they are completely dissociated from the jurisdiction in which they play, the countries in which they play. They root for players. They root for, you know, for Barcelona, or they root for any Chelsea, any of the other ones, some of the Italian clubs.
Man
and
City.
The road to globalization perhaps goes around the national anthem and perhaps takes less time reminding us that this game is rooted in Americana and more time kind of reminding us that this is a global sport. Just another perspective.
Harriet writes, good morning, esteemed panel. When nationalistic symbols such as the flag and the national anthem are valued over freedom of speech in the Constitution, we are on the road to fascism. Civil disobedience and nonviolent protest are keys to maintaining our democracy. Scott writes, kneeling during the national anthem is not un-American. Active citizenship is not un-American. Racism is un-American. Police brutality is un-American. A president ranting at individuals who are peaceably trying and promoting social justice is also un-American. Kevin said, please get back to the bigger issues. The 25th Amendment, the Mueller investigation, health care. We will.
Bigger than the there's nothing bigger than the NFL. Come on.
This attack on that. Baseball is really upsetting.
You know,
you, though.
I think
exactly.
Rosemary wrote a great. Somebody wrote in, and Rosemary wrote a great thing on her Facebook. Rosemary Armeo wrote a great thing on her Facebook page over the weekend of going, you know what? We have to in now under this current administration, we have to multitask. It's all important.
Right.
We can talk about this. We can talk about healthcare. We can talk about North Korea. We can talk about all of it, and we will. And
he's
we
doing
have.
This
and
because of that. And one of the dangerous things about him is that he uses race to distract from his policy failures.
Well, I'd also like to remind the public that this is the same person who delivered remarks, I believe, here in New York State about a month ago in front of a number of police benevolent associations who indicated to the crowd that perhaps police should not, you know, gently tuck heads into the, you know, police cars, that they should just get a little rougher.
Well, in which the police associations denounced him for.
Right, but remember during the campaign, get him out of here, rough him up while you're at it, you know?
I'll pay the bills.
I'll pay the bills. I mean, and I remember there's a clip of Trump during the campaign where somebody rushed the stage and he ducked like a little girl because he really is a coward inside.
Now.
Don't denigrate girls.
Libby. No, I'm sorry.
Libby,
I can say that.
I didn't
girls.
Say that.
But
you
he
know,
is. He ducked like a, you know, like a scared little kid. How
I'm
about
telling
that?
You, if I'm on stage and somebody comes running, I'm gone.
Well, you know,
I'm ducking.
I get that, but you know, when you're running for president, you got to have a backbone.
Yeah.
No, you
well,
do
it doesn't mean you have to be shot. Right. I mean, I'm all for.
Yeah.
All right. Eric says, besides being a silly distraction, this behavior from the president is reminiscent of the nationalist nonsense espoused by leaders like Vladimir Putin. Trump is using his office to bludgeon his opponents and rile up his base. That was a question I had, though. And Alan and Keith, does this even work for the base, though? I mean, we saw a lot of football fans there who I'm sure were perhaps Trump voters who were supporting these players. I mean,
well,
Steph Curry, for God's sakes.
We don't really know. We don't really know yet. We do know that I think it was Keith who mentioned how much was a ticket to a major to a
if
national
you're
football
going to an, if you're go well, if you're going to an NBA game, particularly in the coast, the team that wins, you're not getting in for less than a couple $100s.
No.
And
think
and that's
that.
If you and that's if you want to watch it on the big screen from your seat in the corner of the arena. So this is, by the way, these are wealthy fans in almost every regard. And yeah, you've created a kind of a long-standing now kind of army of dissenters, and particularly since the NFL and its players were a very diverse lot. I mean, and I don't want to suggest that it falls along racial lines, but certainly you had a lot of people in the NFL in certain parts of the South that may have been raised in more Republican jurisdictions who were on the stump for Trump, and I think his attack on their league becomes very challenging for them. So I think he's blowing it on this. He is taking stabs at people that he doesn't need to take. It's not going to win him any votes. Now, let's be also quite honest. He doesn't have a lot of people in the NBA, particularly on the coast in San Francisco, that were voting for him anyway. So Steph Curry was not going to be winning him a lot of praise regardless, but it really seems like a poor kind of maneuver for him to take on the NFL.
David Soares.
I think, you know, his attack on Steph Curry in the NBA was particularly foolish given the fact that the NBA forced the sale of one of its teams in the last 2 years because the owner had made some salacious and racist remarks that were caught on tape, in addition to, I believe, an ex-wife or a girlfriend that had publicized those remarks.
I think we also can't forget that Trump has a history with the NFL in that, you know, he was an owner in the AFL. He drove that into bankruptcy. He wanted to buy
the USFL.
I'm sorry,
USFL.
Sorry. Thank you. USFL drove that into bankruptcy. Wanted to, you guys know more than me, but he wanted to buy into the NFL.
The Bills.
Wouldn't. It was not a club that he was allowed to get into. So I think there's also that backdrop of disdain.
A petulant
Very
little.
Interesting.
Here's a letter I like. It's from Michael and said, I don't see kneeling as a sign of disrespect. Isn't it a humbling gesture? Maybe a time to pray for the future of our country? Maybe for a change in leadership? This idea
like
of
Stevie, yeah.
You know, I've wondered that from the beginning, from the Kaepernick thing, that why kneeling? I personally didn't like it when they sat. I think that's disrespectful, but I thought kneeling was a fine gesture.
I mean, maybe it's a gesture. It's a gesture, whether it's a kneeling or a fist, your right fist in the air.
Mm-hmm. To me, sitting is something different. But
it's a gesture of defiance.
But I always thought, wouldn't kneeling be appropriate?
All right.
But I think turning your back on the flag historically was the one that got everyone outraged. Unfortunately, but in most arenas and stadiums, there's a flag on pretty much every catty corner. So
yeah.
It's really hard to turn your back on the flag in an NFL stadium.
Get in a rotator. Margie says, I think, /hope, Donnie may have finally shot himself in the foot with his base. Shoot someone in the face on Fifth Avenue? No problem. Grab him by the you-know-what? Go for it. Mess with football? No way. Sigh, says Margie.
Well, you know, there were people interviewed yesterday who thought he was absolutely correct. I mean, his base, I think, yes, they like football, but they also are these uber nationalists who think the flag is the ultimate symbol and needs to be respected no matter what. Doesn't matter what the flag stands for, that there's First Amendment issues or freedom of religion or freedom of speech issues involved here. But they, I don't know how much his base will crumble.
Well, let me just end on this of the subject. But that is that there was something, at least for me, there was something that, and we saw this in the earliest game yesterday that took place over in London, when you have all of the players, all of the coaches, and the owners all locking arms during that. Some players were mm-hmm. kneeling, some were standing. But, I mean, that, to me, to do that league-wide said an awful lot. I don't know, Keith, how they got that together. It seems to have everybody on the same page, but it worked.
That's what Trump did. And I think the point's kind of essentially been made. Generally speaking, the sitting or standing for the national anthem, if you look at the numbers, tends to fall along racial, in some cases geographic, and in many cases age lines. So we can say with a relative degree of certainty who's going to support the players, you know, kneeling for the anthem, who's going to support them standing. But Trump's attack wasn't simply an attack on the idea of sitting for the national anthem. It was very much an attack on the individual athletes and the sport itself and the owners. I mean, I apologize for the vernacular, but it was almost as if he was calling out all of their individual manhoods.
Yeah.
And that became a little bit more than I think even
of black
supporters, even people who believe that you should be standing for the flag, that I think was very hard to stomach. And it became very personal. And I think that's where he somehow managed to galvanize and unify all of these people who, generally speaking, don't work together.
All right. We need to take a break. We're going to end this particular portion of the subject, and we're going to move to healthcare, so we'll lighten it up a little bit. Keith Strudler is the director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. You can visit him somewhere on the New Jersey Turnpike. Where are you? I don't know.
I don't know. I think I'm Ramapo. I'm at a McDonald's. I've been eyeing these McFrappes coming in and out.
All right. Well, yeah, go get yourself one extra whipped cream. And thank you for being with us this morning, sir. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
Very nice to have you with us. All right. We're going to continue our conversation and talk about the rest of the news after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. We are pleased to have the following panelists with us: WAMC's Alan Chartok, political consultant Libby Post, communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, and Albany County District Attorney David Soares. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We want to get into other topics. We'll try to do a lightning round here and try to get to as many as we can in our final 20 minutes or so. With time running short, the authors of the latest plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act shifted money in the bill to Alaska and Maine. Why, you ask? Well, they are represented by Republican senators who appear reluctant to support it. So you bribe them. The revised version of the bill, written by Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, would provide extra money for an unnamed high-spending, low-density state, a last-minute change seemingly aimed at Alaska and its holdout, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has yet to say how she will vote. It would also send money toward Maine, whose Republican Senator Susan Collins has said earlier on Sunday that she would almost certainly vote no. Mr. Cassidy circulated a table on Sunday showing a state-by-state impact of the revised bill from 2020 to 2026. It indicates that Alaska would receive 3% more money under the bill than the under current law, while Maine would get 43% more. However, the numbers and calculations could not be independently confirmed. Similar estimates prepared by Mr. Cassidy's office for the earlier version of the bill differed significantly from estimates by the Kaiser Family Foundation and health policy consulting firms. So we should say that since we last met, the big story, of course, was that John McCain announced on Friday that he would not be voting for this particular bill, basically putting it on the ropes, and with Susan Collinson saying that it's very unlikely that she will vote, it appears all but dead, and yet we wait.
Two things. One, I love the fact that they're calling this the second Alaska purchase. I think that's extraordinary. Did any of you happen to hear on NPR this morning the Wisconsin senator humping and pumping through the explanation as to why this was all justified? I've never heard anything so pathetic in my entire life. The guy just couldn't get it out. He couldn't talk.
Is this Ron Johnson?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, when you look at what we have here, that it's so, Teresa, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically, even if this works, if this plan works of buying out Maine and Alaska, you still have a really bad bill that may help two other states a little more than the others.
Right, and they added some sweeteners overnight early this morning, too, for Kentucky, because they're still trying to get Rand Paul. And then they added another Alaska provision that says 25% hike in federal Medicaid funding as well. So, but regardless of all of the sweeteners, it still does not provide protections for people with pre-existing conditions. They say that it does, but in fact, they were read the language yesterday on the Sunday shows, and they kept lying about it. But it's clearly there's a huge gap that makes it clear that you can raise premiums on people with pre-existing conditions, and there's no protections in this bill for that. There's still per capita caps. That you still lifetime limits, or there are no lifetime limits. This bill, yesterday on one of the news shows, one of the Republicans was talking about how, Republicans should vote for this if they believe in the sanctity of life, because right. This does protect the sanctity of life. And that struck me, because this bill, in fact, does not protect life. It may protect life from inception till birth, but not beyond that.
But even
conception till birth.
But they're talking about not covering for maternity.
Right.
So
doesn't
how,
even you're
how
right.
Does that,
doesn't even
how does
cover
that work.
There's no more benefits package.
That's right.
There's no more requirement that employers provide health care. This will decimate not the health care system, not just for the people who right now get their insurance through the Affordable Care Act. It will have reverberations throughout the entire health system. And even if this doesn't pass, the other news that you had over the weekend is that the Health and Human Services, during the enrollment period,
right,
is going to shut down the computers on the weekends so that they can do maintenance. And so further blocking just this.
This is for
cynicism.
The current program,
right.
The ACA,
for the current,
for the current
program,
ACA. Yes.
So
yeah.
Even if this bill doesn't pass,
they are still
actively working to destroy the healthcare
to undermine
system.
It.
Well, destabilizing the marketplace for affordable healthcare. I mean, that's when they talk about how the prices are going up. They're going up because the government is not providing any of those subsidies to the insurance companies that they promised in the Affordable Care Act. I'll tell you, to Alan's point, one of the challenges, I think, if you're a Republican senator or a member of the House of Representatives on television, is your messaging, because they've been so inconsistent. They've been so inconsistent. They don't know what's in the bill, and therefore they cannot come out with a very uniform talking point for support for this bill.
But I think everyone should call their member of Congress today and say, I know this is a Senate vote, but a House vote. Are you for or against this bill? Every member of Congress needs to go on record, be put on record. Are you for or against the Graham-Cassidy bill? Because, you know, what are people really...
Well, it'll pass in the House of Representatives. The first one
It would
passed.
Pass if it gets
well, absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. It'll pass.
You know...
But I think, you know, before whether or not the Senate passes it, I think people... Is this what our members of Congress are for? Because this will destroy, this will decimate.
People will die in the streets, and that's what they want.
And it's distracting from the effort. There was a bipartisan effort to try to shore up the Affordable Care Act, because everybody agrees that needs to be improved.
There was, and I think, and many are pointing to Sanders' bill that he unveiled last week as being a destabilizing factor. Now, I firmly agree
with that.
Yeah, I will just say this, that you know, my emotional relationship with John McCain, you know, he restored my faith. I'm just wondering how long it's going to be before he does something again to me that causes me to fall out of love with him. But I think what he did on Friday was an amazing gesture, because he also took a lot of pressure off of other senators that I think were
who had
their arms being wrung by the Mitch McConnell.
Interesting profile on him.
I have one other question. It's very quick along the lines that David has just announced. Do you think that most of these Republican senators don't have mirrors in their houses?
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
Do you mean that they can't see themselves?
Well, how do they look at themselves in the mirror when they're shaving?
When you're taking health care away from 20 million Americans,
that's
or
true.
You know, I mean, John McCain, let's face it, he's in bad shape. He knows it. He's facing his eternal existence. He's doing the right thing, and he's always done the right thing, or most of the time he's done the right thing. I agree with David. I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. But I don't think he's in that same spot, David, that he used to be.
I agree with you. I think when he looks in the mirror, he sees himself and he sees his predicament right now. But I think, to your point, when the other senators are looking at themselves in the mirror, they're looking at their donors. And
that's right.
I think that this is a strategy that hadn't been employed before, where, you know, the White House is reaching out to the donors of these senators and putting pressure on these senators through the donors.
So my blood went cold when the president tweeted out and said, we will get health care eventually. So isn't that the signal that even if this goes by the wayside, we're still going to have to suffer through another one of these three or four plans?
But talking about the donors, the Koch brothers have made it clear their money's going to dry up unless they do this, unless Obamacare goes away
and they do
the tax reform.
Well, they want to introduce their tax package on Wednesday, and it's over $1 trillion in the hole, reportedly, and they need to figure out how to pay for it. And the way they want to pay for it is by fundamentally changing the way the Medicaid program works in this country and the way healthcare works. And you heard it from Mark Short, the White House guy, over the weekend. They just, it's not sustainable for the government to be supporting people's healthcare. I mean, that is the philosophical difference here.
And it's less sustainable if those responsibilities now trickle down to the states through block grants.
Right. That's right. He says, we got to give the power to the states, and how it's inequitably, the funding right now is not distributed equitably. Well, the reason why some states get more and other states get less is because some states did not take advantage of enrolling their people in health care. And so, but 33 states will lose money under this proposal. 33 states.
And it will bankrupt New York.
It will bankrupt New York and other states. And there's no provision for because it's a block grant, meaning every state gets a finite of money every year. It doesn't depend on need. It depends on that's what a block grant is. So what happens to Texas? If this had been put in place 2 years ago before Harvey, and then you have Harvey, Or what would have happened to Florida? And then all of a sudden you have people who are not employed, so they need health care, so they qualify for Medicaid. So then what happens to those states? Those people can't get health care because their block grant doesn't account for the fact that this uptick in people on the rolls.
Which is why it's so interesting. The Republican governors, Arizona, Massachusetts, my state, where the guy is becoming a hero, Governor Baker, because, you know, he is in their faces. He knows what's good for his people, and he doesn't respond to the same bell. Now, of course, it's a blue state, and he has to keep the blues happy. But the fact of the matter is, he's doing what's right. And that's extraordinary to me.
I want to move on to another story, and David mentioned it earlier in talking about Angela Merkel winning a fourth term as chancellor in elections on Sunday, placing her in the front ranks of Germany's post-war leaders, even as her victory was dimmed by the entry of a far-right party into parliament for the first time in more than 60 years. The far-right party Alternative for Germany got some 13% of the vote, nearly three times the 4.7% that it received in 2013, a significant showing of voter anger over immigration and inequality as support for the two main parties sagged from 4 years ago.
Yep.
Merkel and her center-right Christian Democrats won. The center held, but it was weakened. The results made clear the far-right populism and anxieties over security and national identity were far from dead in Europe, as you were saying earlier, David. So we are seeing this not just here, but around the world.
The angst is everywhere. The fact that opportunities are drying up for people is really causing us to abandon our better angels. And it's an issue that I think for the both parties in this country, we really have to take a serious look at this before we move into the midterms and again, ramping up for the elections in 20. What are we going to do to create economic opportunities for the poor and marginalized? Which, in my opinion, today, you know, really means your middle class. We have a president that we never thought we'd have. I don't think anyone could have dreamt of waking up to find us in the current, you know, place that we're in right now. But the reality is people are struggling and we feel less secure about our prosperity. And that is causing people to, again, abandon our better angels.
And that's why I worry about this tax proposal, because if you look at their proposed budget cuts, and then you look at the trial balloons that have come out overnight on the tax proposal that they allegedly are going to put on the table, it shifts tax breaks to the top brackets, and it will really hurt the middle class, and it may destabilize the economy. I mean, we saw this with Ronald Reagan. It's the you know, Reagan package all over again. Deep tax cuts without any way to pay for it, and they target it to the upper class, further exacerbating the historic economic divide we have right now.
And they haven't even got the guts, by the way, to say that there is going to be an upper class tax cut. They're saying that's undecided now, but we all know what's going to happen.
And it's the same beneficiaries that will use racism and use immigration to further that chasm that exists now.
So to pit the various groups of economically insecure people against each other.
That's
rather
exactly
than
what they do. They've always done that.
Right.
The ruling class has always done that. That's their modus operandi for generations, if not centuries. And now we are where we are. You know, the past 8 years under Obama, there was a little bit of healing that went on. And now this bill and this tax cut, you know, this is about the new depression coming. And if anybody thinks that that's not going to happen, that there's not going to be a massive economic fallout from this, you know, and it's Trump's people, their base, his base, that's going to get hurt the most.
And we've seen this play before. But back to Merkel just for a moment. I will say, even though the situation now is difficult for her because of the alignments that she has to work out, you got to assume that the European community,
everybody,
NATO, the UN, there's a sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm.
All over Europe and probably all around the world, because she really has emerged as the leader in Europe and probably the leader of the free world. So I think we all have to be have a, I think there is a collective sigh of relief that mm-hmm. she's still in power.
And I think that over time, what we'll see is because of the instability, you know, globally, I think we will see a unifying, you know, coming together for her in support of her leadership.
But you have to worry. A lot of the instability is because there's so much migration. The reason there's so much migration is because there's so much violence. And what is the U.S. doing to exacerbate that? You know, more bombing in Libya, more funding of bombing in Yemen, more bombing in the last 6 months in Syria than there has been in a long time. And all of that, you know, pushes people out of their countries.
And banning those people from coming into our country.
Yes, this ban yesterday is... I'll let you speak to that, but wow.
All right. Any last words for anyone?
Kushner.
Yes, I have a last word.
Your word was, and Teresa, yours was Kushner
his
and
the emails.
And the private
but
emails.
But his emails. Right. What about Kushner's emails? Right. So is Donald Trump going to start chanting, lock him up, lock him
no,
up?
No, stop. Stop.
His emails, but the emails.
Teresa,
emails.
Why haven't you gotten used to hypocrisy?
I think my last words is this. While, you know, we're here talking about, you know, whether people should kneel or not, we're talking about the weather, we're talking about Germany. There is a prosecutor in Washington, D.C., that isn't reading all of the stories that we're reading and isn't talking about the things that we're talking about. They're busy searching for evidence and building a case, and
yes.
I think we can't lose sight of that.
That's the thing. You know, it's like all of this stuff is going on. Bob Mueller's still doing
his
job.
Absolutely.
And it's great. You know, it's just he's just keeps doing his job. And yes, all of this is this shiny stuff for us to for diversion, but he's not being diverted.
Can I say David.
We're out of it. Okay. Okay. 10 seconds.
I was just going to say, if David had the resources that Mueller has, there would be nobody left in the legislature.
Oh, we yeah, we'd need to put Ferenc signs up.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you very much to everybody, and for coming at the last minute, especially David and Keith. I appreciate that. We will be back tomorrow with another discussion, and we'll continue our discussion here on this program right after this.